Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome indeed to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church, and for the next half hour or so, your host for the Big Three podcast. It's great to have you with me today, wherever you might be listening, in the car or on a walk or on a run or doing some housework or gardening, whatever the case might be. Great to have you with me as we dive into three questions that were raised from our sermon on Sunday. We are continuing the Encounter series, the latest resource from Olive Tree Media, looking at the encounters that Jesus had with people in the Gospels and encounters that Jesus has with people today. In our life groups, we are exploring the resource, the video resource and the interviews with people who have encountered Jesus today and touching on the biblical story. And on Sundays, we're basically looking at the biblical story, the account, and leaving much of the interview and whatnot to the life groups. This last week, Roxanne Lawler, our associate pastor, was preaching on the cost of the encounter with Jesus, looking primarily at James and John coming to Jesus in Mark's account and asking for seats on his right and left when he came into his kingdom, and looking at the cost that they were called to. Ultimately, you know, they were called to death itself. Tradition says they were martyred for their faith. But for most of us, as Rox pointed out, that's not likely what we're going to face. Instead, we need to be people who are embracing the life of service, and that becomes a kind of a place where we count the cost. So from that sermon on Sunday, there were a few questions that were asked. So here's what we're going to be looking at. What other costs are there to following Jesus? So as I said, Rox talked about both, you know, shall we say, the extremes, martyrdom, and then the opportunities that we have just to live a life of service as Jesus modeled for us. But what other costs are there? Can we be more specific? Secondly, in the book of Mark, James and John ask Jesus this question, but in the book of Matthew, their mother asks Jesus, is there a difference? Does it change what we take from it? So we'll have a bit of a look at that, a little bit of comparative study of the two synoptic accounts and the ways in which they're told. And then finally, Rox mentioned what happened to Peter, James, and John. Do we know what happened to the other disciples? So a little bit of a history question. So we've got some good things to engage in as we continue to seek to take the conversation a little bit deeper in relationship to the encounter with Jesus. So the first question is perhaps the most significant of the questions that we're going to address today. Not that the others are not significant, but they're very different. This question, what other costs are there to following Jesus, I think is a pretty significant one. I think the heart behind the question, this is where I do a little bit of guesswork, really, but I think the heart behind the question is really about, can we be more specific? Yes, there may be, in certain parts of the world, a high likelihood that the cost is going to be very obvious, very overt, and very significant. You hear stories, say, of people who come to faith in, say, in Muslim countries, where part of the cost of their faith is basically being kicked out of their family, their life being put in danger. Like, they're very real, very present, very significant risks. There's risks of imprisonment in certain parts of the world. There's risks of, I guess what I would call high-level persecution, right? Where businesses get torched and family homes get graffitied and there's threats against their lives. So there's those really big, overt, significant costs to following Jesus. And I think, you know, early in the piece, you know, we'll come back to this when we talk a little bit about the fate of the disciples, but early in the piece for the disciples, that was the cost. There was a really significant heightened risk of physical harm for following Jesus and for being a part of the Christian movement. There were economic risks, you know, counting the cost. The book of Revelation seems to be pointing to that component, that being associated with the Christian movement was bad for business. It meant that people would bypass you. It meant that you were left out of trade guilds, or because you'd stepped away from trade guilds because of your faith in Jesus and the idolatry that was often associated with them. And so you lost out on contracts or opportunities or whatever the case is. So there's a whole lot of those kinds of overt costs. The question, and Rock's raised this, is what does that mean for us? Because yes, you know, we live in a culture and in a society where Christianity is not particularly well regarded, although I do believe that that is changing. It's not particularly well understood. And we have come from a position of cultural influence. So even though it doesn't necessarily feel that way anymore, the fact of the matter is, you know, we I think could call ourselves in some way, shape, and form a nation that has some Christian heritage and Christian roots. And so even though there's been a pretty big shift away from those roots, they're still there. And all of those things shape our experience of the cost. So I reckon, you know, to answer the question, to be a little bit more specific, I reckon that for us, the cost is not thrust upon us, right? So if you're in a country or in a part of the world where being a Christian is illegal, the cost is thrust upon you, right? You place your faith in Jesus, and the next thing you know, you have some really significant, serious consequences to deal with. The costs are kind of built in, they're obvious, and they happen to you. I think for many people in the West, part of the great challenge of following Jesus in the West is that the cost is not necessarily thrust upon us from outside. There are behaviors that we might call, you know, Christian, right? Being honest. But you don't have to be a Christian to be honest in business or in your dealings with people, because it's good business practice and all of those sorts of things. There are lots of people who would share Christian values even if they don't necessarily follow Jesus, right? So we have to not generate the cost. That's a little bit, that's too much. But we do have to be very careful to identify the places where there may be cost. So I think for us, we often have to kind of try to step back from our culture. And I reckon that the answer that I would give to this question, what other costs are there to following Jesus, is that they are a little bit different for each of us, a little bit, but they're related primarily to understanding the juxtaposition and the contrast between the values of our society and the values of the kingdom, which is ultimately at the heart of Jesus's interaction with James and John. He says to them, you know, the Gentiles, the Romans or anyone else really, they lord their authority over others. So they take that authority and they use their power and they use their influence for themselves. Jesus says that's not the way you're supposed to do it. You are to serve. The greatest must become the least. It's just a completely different set of values. And the disciples are then invited, then and now, to consider that, to think, okay, if the value of the kingdom, if the primary value of the kingdom when it comes to influence and power is service first, what does that mean? And what cost might there be for us if we're going to pursue the values of the kingdom instead of the values of our world? So, for instance, you know, there may be we may bypass or be bypassed in terms of moving up the corporate ladder. That's not necessarily a bad thing, being recognized for our increased competencies or skills or whatever the case might be is fine, but that may be a cost for us. And I think we're invited by Scripture more generally to consider other areas, other values, other behaviors, other attitudes that are in conflict with, in a greater or lesser degree, the values and priorities and behaviors of the kingdom. So I think when we consider, for instance, our financial giving, right, a place where we would kind of immediately associate with cost, I think that there's space for us to be considering what are the values of the kingdom in relationship to finances, and what are the values of finances in our world, and where's the conflict, and is there a cost that I'm going to bear in the world in order to step into the values of the kingdom? Because ultimately what it is, the cost, I mean, it's almost ironic, isn't it? Because Jesus says to gain life, to gain greatness, to gain all the things that you want, you actually have to embrace the values of the kingdom where you're going to live, not the kingdom of the world. And that, so to some degree, it doesn't cost us anything. We serve those around us, and what happens is we gain, shall we say, greatness in the kingdom. Now, it's not the greatness that then means we can lord it over people, because that's the ways of the world. So the cost is to our worldly values, to our worldly priorities, to our worldly behaviors, not necessarily to the kingdom behavior. So part of our, you know, our exploration needs to be not only what are the values of the kingdom in our world and where are they in conflict, but also, I guess, to ask ourselves and to ask the Holy Spirit to continue to transform us so that the values of the kingdom, the priorities of the kingdom, the behaviors of the kingdom are the values, priorities, and behaviors that we most want in our lives, so that the cost of behaving differently won't feel so much like a cost, but feel like a win for us as we step more fully into the kingdom. So I think the costs can be all sorts of things. You know, the decisions that we make to modify our behaviors that may have some implications for the way in which we live our lives, behaviors that are different from our neighbors or from our colleagues or from our friends. Values and priorities that are different that may cost us something in relationship to those around us, but ultimately which leads us to step more fully into the values of the kingdom. So I'm not sure that that's a more specific answer, but I hope that that's kind of a next step in terms of how we can go about counting the cost. Because as I said, for us, the cost is not thrust upon us. It's kind of internally generated, right? It's generated by the conflict between those values, which are often below the surface. But that's a really good place, I think, to start as we encounter what it means to, or as when we consider what the cost to encountering Jesus is actually all about. The second question that we'll look at today is this. In the book of Mark, James and John ask Jesus, but in the book of Matthew, their mother asks Jesus, is there a difference? Does it change what we take from it? So I've talked a little bit about this before, I know. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are referred to as the synoptic gospels because they tell the story of Jesus from a very similar perspective. They tell the story beginning with, you know, John the Baptist and Jesus's ministry. He has one trip to Jerusalem. They kind of frame up the journey as kind of one journey to Jerusalem. John's gospel is told quite differently. It doesn't include, say, exorcisms. It doesn't really include parables like the parables in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There's a lot more dialogue, all of those sorts of things. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke not only tell the story from a similar perspective, but they often tell the same stories. They will often modify them to suit their purposes. So sometimes shortening them, sometimes including a few extra details. They'll place them in slightly different contexts, not always, but sometimes, in order, again, to serve their purposes for why they were writing their Gospels. And so the question has been asked by an observant reader who has looked at the example in Matthew and in Mark and noted that there is a difference. In Matthew's account, James and John enlist the help of their mother. And they come to Jesus, and she basically asks the question, would you give these sons of mine positions of authority in your kingdom? And then Jesus talks to them. He basically says, can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with? The same question he asks in Mark. And they say, we can. So it's almost as if the mother was being used to broker the conversation. So actually, I had a quick look at one of my commentaries on Matthew, because I suspected that there's not a great deal of difference between the two stories, because, I mean, well, ultimately there isn't. In both instances, Jesus does the same kind of teaching. He draws the contrast, as we were just talking about, between the kingdom of the world and the kingdom of heaven. He draws attention to the fact that, in both accounts, that the disciples still, right on the cusp of being in Jerusalem, still don't get what Jesus is on about. The interaction between James and John and Jesus, or James and John and their mother and Jesus, takes place in both Gospels after Jesus' third teaching about his death, his third prediction of his death. And in the synoptic accounts, when Jesus predicts his death, there's almost immediately a misunderstanding about what that means. I think that's the first one in both accounts. It's Peter. You know, Jesus says, I'm the Messiah, must suffer and die, and Peter rebukes him. And we assume he's rebuking him over his view of the Messiah. We find similar things happening in the second prediction and then again after the third. So I think ultimately, if I can answer the last part of the question, does it change what we take from it? I would say no. Ultimately, it's meant to demonstrate the lack of understanding that the disciples had so late in the piece. I mean, this is at the end of 3 years with Jesus. They are just about in Jerusalem for, well, the events of Jesus' last week on earth. And they still just don't get it at all. And I think it's also an opportunity for Jesus to teach again on the differences between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of the world. So I think the takeaways are the same. In terms of, you know, I guess the question of, you know, is there a difference in, you know, what's going on there? It may be as simple as Matthew wanting to reflect, more of the Jewish background. The commentary that I just had a quick look at today made the point that in Jewish culture, like mums, like older mums in particular, had a degree of cultural respect that was not necessarily afforded to younger women, and that they could often ask for things that other people could not. So there's actually an interesting example in the early part of 1 Kings where Adonijah, Solomon's brother, gets Bathsheba, Solomon's mom, to ask Solomon for a favor for him. He wants to marry one of David's concubines, which apparently was a really big political issue. And he ends up losing his life over it. That tells you how significant it was. But the fact that he got the queen mother to speak to the king on his behalf is kind of what we find here. So it seems as if the disciples, at least in Matthew's account, may at least have had just a little bit of sensitivity to the fact that they were asking a really big deal, that they were asking for seats of authority in the kingdom, and that was not an easy thing to do. So enlisting their mother, who had some, not social credibility, but that social respect, and who could ask, not the unaskable question, but could ask the big questions without the same kind of repercussions, right? May just be a reflection of the Jewish culture that Matthew in particular seems to want to reflect. There's a number of, most scholars would say that Matthew's account of Jesus' life seems to have been appealing and has been written focused for a little bit, not entirely, but focused a little bit for Jewish Christians. There's a number of hints and whatnot in terms of how he tells the story that Jewish Christians may have been his primary audience or his target audience in terms of why he was writing. But nonetheless, there's a sense that he may have just been reflecting the Jewish culture. To some degree, then, in Mark's account, the absence of James and John's mother, I mean, Mark's targeted audience, according to many commentators, is a Gentile audience. So it may not have had the same kind of cultural resonance for them. And ultimately, it was James and John who would have been asking the question. I don't think it was a matter of, you know, James and John's mother, it's not like the helicopter parent, you know, in a local school who's coming to talk to the principal about something that their little Johnny needs. That's not what's happening here. This is not a matter of, you know, an ambitious mother trying to make a way for her sons. This was most likely her sons saying to her, can you ask Jesus this? Not because they were afraid to ask, but because they thought that this might get them a better hearing or whatever the case is. So ultimately, they're the ones asking the question. And Mark's gospel just kind of, shall we say, cuts to the chase. So again, I hope that makes some sense of the differences. I don't think there's a fundamental difference in the messaging, but I do think that it may be that the target audience for who they were thinking about when they were writing their gospel, Matthew thought this would be a helpful a detail to include. And Mark was like, it's not a particularly important detail for people who were reading this, that ultimately what he wanted to do was to draw attention to who it was who was asking. So anyway, I'm guessing on that last part, but again, that's part of the beauty and joy of studying the Bible and engaging with the gospels. Final question is a little bit of a historical one. So that Rox mentioned what happened to Peter, James, and John. Do we know what happened to the other disciples? With Peter, James, and John, the only one for whom we have biblical evidence of their death is James, who was the first of the disciples who was martyred. He appears to have taken on the leadership of the early church. So Peter is the early voice. And then when he faces persecution and leaves Jerusalem, it appears that James kind of stepped into that leadership position. So in Acts chapter 15, there's a council that's held, or what's often referred to as a council, to try to answer the question of what do we do with the Gentiles? The Gentiles are coming to faith. How do we work that out in relationship to Jewishness and faith in Jesus? At any rate, James is the one who speaks last. Peter speaks, Paul and Barnabas speak, but it's James who kind of speaks last and kind of makes the, shall we say, formalizes the decision that they're making. And then we're told a little bit later in in the book of Acts that he was martyred by Herod Agrippa. Outside of that, we don't really have any other information about the end of the disciples. We believe that John was exiled at Patmos when he wrote the book of Revelation, when he received the visions and wrote down that apocalypse. But we don't know what happened to him beyond that. So we are reliant on church tradition. And church tradition can be a little bit tricky. Over the years, the traditions have grown up, and all sorts of fantastic bits and pieces have been added to them. But in general, my feeling, not that I've studied the early church traditions really, really closely, but the impression that I get is there's no real reason to question some of those really early traditions. By the time you get into, you know, believers of the second, third centuries, it can be a little bit trickier sometimes. But with the disciples, I think we've got a fair, I think there's, I think the church tradition can be taken, perhaps with a grain of salt. I wouldn't want to preach it as gospel, but nonetheless, I think it's fairly accurate. And ultimately, the church tradition states that all of the disciples, apart from John, died of unnatural causes, that all of them were martyred, although the means by which they were martyred and the locations in which they were martyred are often up for debate. So, as Rox mentioned, church tradition says that Peter was executed in Rome under Nero, and that he was crucified, but that at his request was crucified upside down in order to distinguish himself, shall we say, from Jesus and not kind of die the same kind of death. We believe that at least one other, I can't remember which one now, I had a quick look again this morning, was crucified on an X-shaped cross. Thomas, church tradition says, managed to get all the way to India to preach the gospel before he was martyred for his faith. There were, I think it was Matthew who was in Egypt. Paul, not a disciple of Jesus per se, well, he was, but not one of the originals. He was beheaded because he was a Roman citizen and therefore afforded that right, I guess. Again, during the persecution of Nero, and all of the other disciples, apart from John, who we believe from church tradition, I think died in Ephesus. At the end of a quite long life, but wasn't martyred for his faith. So ultimately the disciples all faced and shall we say drank the cup that Jesus drank, right? They experienced persecution and ultimately lost their faith for the cause, which from an apologetic perspective is actually a really important part of is a key piece of evidence for the resurrection, right? If the disciples had just made up the resurrection, part of the question is why would they be willing to die for a lie? I mean, you know, people die for truth, but they don't necessarily die for a lie. At some point in time, the lie and the consequences, the gap gets too big, right? And all 12 of them face persecution. And all but one were martyred for their faith. And so that's, I think, a fairly important piece. So again, we don't really, really know. Church tradition, of course, you know, it's 2,000 years old. It's, you know, it's a tradition. It's not written down someplace in some sort of official record. So we do, we have references in early church writings to what happened to the apostles. And so I think that it's reasonable to assume that those stories are broadly more or less accurate and true reflections of what happened. It makes sense in the context of what we know happened in the early church, you know, from the book of Acts and those sorts of things. So yeah, that's the answer to that question. I can't say too much more. I Googled it and, you know, the little AI companion thing popped up with, you know, what church tradition says about all of the disciples. The only one it didn't mention, actually, now that I think about it, was it Matthias, the fellow who replaced Judas in the book of Acts? I didn't see that one up, but you can always look that up yourself. That's the beauty of the internet, I suppose. Although, do be careful about the things that you trust. But nonetheless, so I hope that's helpful to provide a little bit of a framework for engaging with that historical question. Well, we've just got a couple more weeks of the Encounter series this coming Sunday and the next, and then we'll be wrapping that series up. So this coming week, Phil Lowe is going to be preaching and looking at another encounter that Jesus has before we wrap this series up in just a couple of weeks' time. Hope you can join me again next week for the Big Three as we continue the conversation to take it a little bit deeper and to continue thinking about the implications of these texts for our lives as we seek to encounter Jesus and be changed by him. Until next week, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, You can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Gaimea Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.